This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, February 4th, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Israel faces its first suicide bombing attack in more than a year. The Green Party gets in the Super Tuesday mix, holding primaries in four states. And Bush releases his budget, $3.1 trillion, yet every domestic program except security gets slashed.
The tragedy of the Bush administration will be that they have left a legacy of debt that is truly stunning in proportion. By any historic measure, this administration will go down as the most fiscally irresponsible in the history of the United States.
All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. There's renewed fighting in Chad today where casualties are believed to be high. Rebels seeking to overthrow Chad's president, Idriss Deby, had temporarily left the capital of N'Djamena after taking control of large parts of the city over the weekend. Now thousands are fleeing the city and aid workers report seeing many dead bodies on the streets. The UN is warned of a serious humanitarian situation with 285,000 refugees and 180,000 internally displaced people in eastern Chad. The UN Security Council is condemning the rebel attack and has given France and other countries a green light to help the government repel rebel forces. Millions of Colombians took to the streets today to call for the disbandment of the FARC. The protest took place in dozens of cities throughout Colombia, the U.S., and several other countries. Manuel Rueda has more from Barranquilla.
Today's protest sprung from 1 million voices against the FARC, a Facebook group that was created in early January by Oscar Morales, an engineer with no political background. Morales led the crowds in his native city of Barranquilla.
We want to show the international community that the Colombian people do not support the FARC, a delinquent terrorist organization that uses kidnapping as a combat tactic. Kidnapping is the worst crime against humanity, and it has to end today.
Morales' Facebook group gained over 200,000 members in its first month, and it has been widely supported by the media and pro-government organizations. Colombia's left-wing opposition initially planned to boycott the protest, arguing that it was ignoring human rights abuses committed by the government and the paramilitaries. But in the days that led to the demonstration, party leaders changed their minds. They called on their followers to join today's protest, with messages that encourage a political solution to the government's war with the FARC. For many Colombians, these rallies reflected their countrymen's longing for peace and national unity. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Barranquilla.
In Britain, an anonymous whistleblower has alleged that a member of parliament was bugged during a jail visit to a constituent who is facing extradition to the United States. The U.S. wants to charge him with raising funds for Chechen separatists and the Taliban. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Just like meetings between lawyers and their clients, meetings between members of parliament and their constituents are supposed to be strictly confidential. The Secretary of State for Justice has begun an inquiry into who ordered this surveillance and why. It appears that this was a counter-terrorist police decision, despite the fact that the man wanted by the US, Barber Ahmed, faces no charges here in Britain. His Member of Parliament, Sadiq Khan, whose visits to him may have been bugged, is one of only a few Muslims in Parliament.
If it were the case that constituents were having their conversations with members of Parliament bugged, then it clearly means that the whole relationship and basis upon which that relationship has been based for decades and, dare I say, centuries, is undermined.
But according to ex-government minister Tony Benn, Britain has long been what he calls a police state, where the secret services routinely bug members of parliament. He claims that even when he served in government, he was unable to get assurances that he was not being bugged. He called the 40-year-old rule supposed to protect MPs and their constituents a complete illusion. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Nigerian police fired 24 new recruits because they tested positive for HIV. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The new recruits were found to be HIV positive after compulsory blood tests were conducted at a police college in northern Nigeria. Just a few days before graduation, the provost of the police college summoned them to his office and ordered them to leave the school immediately. Nigerian civil society groups campaigning against discrimination of people living with the AIDS virus say the dismissal of the police recruits because of their HIV status contradicts Nigeria's policy that no one should be denied a job because they are HIV positive. One of the groups, the Social Economic Rights and Accountability Project, has threatened to go to court unless the police recruits are immediately recalled. The police action reflects the growing discrimination against people living with the virus that causes AIDS. For Free Speech Radio, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Israel was hit with its first suicide bombing in more than a year today. One woman is dead and eight people wounded in the southern town of Dimona. Police shot a second suicide bomber before he could detonate his explosive belt. Three Palestinian militant groups have claimed responsibility, although it's not yet clear who is actually behind the bombing. Officials also don't know if the bomber entered Israel from Gaza through a hole in the border that was blasted open by Hamas 12 days ago. Israel followed the suicide bombing with an airstrike on a car in the northern Gaza Strip. Early reports claim a senior Palestinian militant was driving the car and was killed. A passenger in the car, as well as a passerby, were wounded in the attack. Iris Mockler has more from Jerusalem.
Israeli security forces had been on high alert following the breach in the border fence between Gaza and Egypt. But they failed to stop two Palestinian suicide bombers who targeted a shopping center in the southern Israeli town of Dimona Monday. This is the first time Dimona, a quiet desert town, better known for its nearby nuclear reactor, has been the target of a suicide attack. Natalia is an immigrant from the former Soviet Union who works in the Dimona shopping center. She saw a woman killed in front of her and says she can't stop thinking about why she herself didn't die. There were two attackers, but the second failed to detonate his bomb. He was lying injured at the scene, and Israeli rescue personnel began to treat him. When they opened his shirt, they saw his explosive belt and warned people to stay away. The first Israeli police officers on the scene were a drug squad unit, headed by Sergeant Kobi Moore. He saw the second bomber lying on the ground and then saw his hand reaching up to detonate his bomb. He shot him, events captured by TV crews in real time. I thought he was dead and that this was just a reflex action, says Moore. But then I saw that 2 minutes later his hand was still moving, and that's when I shot him. I couldn't take the risk that he would kill anyone else. The Dimona attack has been condemned by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. But in Gaza, the Islamic group Hamas celebrated by handing out sweets to people in the street. It's not yet clear if the attackers came from Gaza, following the breach in the border fence with Egypt, which saw tens of thousands of Palestinians leaving the Gaza Strip over the past 12 days. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the militant wing of the Fatah Party led by Abbas, was one of the groups which took credit for the bombing. They even released a martyrs video of the two young men, Luay al-Arwani and Musa Arafat, from Gaza. The mother of one of the boys spoke from Gaza. But when this video is compared to pictures of the bomber shot by Israeli police on the scene, they don't match. He has a different face and build. This mystery suggests there may be more than one Palestinian cell active at the moment. Israel and Egypt have an unfenced border almost 200 miles long. Egyptian forces say they've prevented three suicide attacks since the Rafah border was breached, stopping three sets of Palestinian militants carrying explosives on their way to Israel. It's not clear what effect this attack will have on peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. One party in Israel's coalition government has called for talks to be suspended. This call has come from Shas, a religious party that has stated that it will leave the coalition as soon as negotiations to divide Jerusalem begin. Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert addressed the Israeli parliament Monday night. He was responding to last week's critical report by an inquiry into the 2006 Lebanon War. Olmert was heckled by opposition MPs and by parents of soldiers who died in Lebanon. When President George W. Bush visited Jerusalem last month, he asked Israel's coalition members to look after his friend Olmert. But Israel's prime minister is a weakened leader, and so is his main opponent, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This may affect negotiations regarding a future Palestinian state more than any other factor. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
Today, gunfire erupted at the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza, reportedly killing one civilian and wounding six soldiers. The shooting began when Egyptian troops attempted to halt the flow of people trying to get back home. The crowd started to throw rocks, and the Egyptians responded with smoke grenades and gunfire. This confrontation comes after the Egypt-Gaza border was resealed yesterday with metal barricades and barbed wire. On January 23rd, Palestinian militants blew a hole in the border, allowing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to cross into Egypt and stock up on food, fuel, and other supplies. An Israeli blockade has made those items scarce in Gaza. Now those who cross the border are mostly back home or on their way there. But as Ursula Lindsay reports from Cairo, who will control the Rafah crossing remains an open question.
Egyptian government officials met separately with representatives of both the Palestinian Authority and Hamas here in Cairo last week. Egypt pressured Hamas to agree to shut the border. Hossam Zaki is a spokesman for the Egyptian Foreign Ministry. He says Egypt is determined to regain control of its border.
What we need to do is to concentrate on how to get back to get the borders back to the situation that is workable and that is acceptable, which is you have the whole entirety of the crossing, about 9 miles, closed without any holes or any exits of any sort, and you have one crossing that's a legal crossing that's working, and this is the focus of our attention now.
The Egyptian government sent thousands of troops to reseal the border and limited the flow of goods to the area so Palestinians would have less incentive to stay. Yet the government was in an awkward spot, given popular support for the Palestinian cause. Egyptian forces were photographed beating back Palestinians with batons. Opposition newspapers ran headlines screaming, "Don't beat the Palestinians." Fahmi Hawedi is a popular Egyptian columnist. He says Egypt has a responsibility to keep the Rafah crossing at least partially open as long as Gaza is under Israeli blockade.
There are three problems: food, the sick, and university students. Egypt has to solve these problems. It has to send food into Gaza. It has to allow the sick to leave to be treated, and it has to let students leave to attend university. We can forbid anyone else from coming and going, but the situation can't go back to the way it was. The same problem will repeat itself.
To achieve this, Hawedi says the Egyptian government should deal with Hamas.
I see no other solution than Egypt dealing with whoever is on the other side of the gate. Egypt can reach an understanding with Hamas. What's the problem?
But Egypt has sided with Israel, the U.S., and the EU in saying the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt should operate according to a 2005 agreement. This agreement predates Hamas's takeover of Gaza. It calls for the Palestinian Authority and Egypt to operate the border with European Union and Israeli oversight. Hamas rejects the agreement. While negotiations continue, there's one thing everyone in Egypt seems to agree on. The real issue isn't who operates the Rafah crossing, they say, but rather the status of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Hossam Zaki.
Well, the goal for us is to establish peace. This is the ultimate thing, and this is what we're working on. And we shouldn't really, divert our attention or the attention of the main parties from the main goal. The main goal is to establish peace. The main goal is to establish a Palestinian state. Had there been a Palestinian state and Gaza Strip was part of it, we wouldn't have seen this type of suffering. We wouldn't have seen this type of human influx over international borders.
Achieving the main goal of peace, however, remains a distant possibility. In the meantime, Gaza's borders are once again sealed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo, Egypt.
Free Speech Radio News is online at www.fsrn.org. Nearly half the U.S. states participate in the process to choose the Democratic and Republican presidential nominees. A large number of those states will go to the polls tomorrow. But the nominees for the Green Party will also be in play on Super Tuesday. Four states, California, Illinois, Massachusetts, and Arkansas, have Green primaries. And for the first time, the Green Party nomination is expected to be hotly contested. Former Georgia Representative Cynthia McKinney will be on the ballot. She announced her candidacy last month. She offers a platform of peace and ending poverty.
It is time to break the vicious cycle where the poor go to war and veterans come home wounded and ignored. It is time, long past time, to stop the bleeding of our national treasury, the more than $1 billion a day that feed the war machine. $1 billion a day can rebuild New Orleans. $1 billion a day can feed the 13 million children living in poverty in this country. $1 billion a day can provide medical care for the 47 million Americans who don't have health insurance.
Meanwhile, anti-corporate Green Party founder Ralph Nader is debating a run. He is not officially announced and is not on the ballot in every applicable state, but a late entry might not hurt his chance of capturing the nomination. He did manage to get on the ballot in the key state of California, which holds 22% of the delegates. Kent Mesplay, Kat Swift, and Jesse Johnson are also running. Today, President Bush released his budget for 2009. The $3.1 trillion proposal would cut funding for domestic programs, increase spending on the military, and drastically increase the national debt. Economists and lawmakers say the budget cuts would add even more burdens to Americans. All the while, Bush continues to push Congress to pass a multi-billion dollar economic stimulus package. FSRN correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
In 2002, Bush became the first American president to sign a $2 trillion budget. His budget breaks a new record this year. It is the first budget to hit $3 trillion, but Bush says it is what Americans need.
This is a good, solid budget. It's a budget that gets to balance in 2012 and saves taxpayers money.
Bush included an extension of his tax cuts in his budget. Many economists say those tax cuts only help wealthy Americans, and it is unlikely Democrats will extend them. Economists also have trouble with Bush's projected balanced budget in 2012.
The problem is that you can't really take his longer-term projection seriously here.
That's John Irons, who is with the Economic Policy Institute. Bush says his budget will only add $400 billion to the nation's deficit. But Irons says Bush left some things out of his budget. In it, Bush only asked for $70 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the real number is around $200 billion. Washington Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell says this is nothing new from Bush.
Just about every budget he's proposed up here has had, you know, funny numbers in which they try to hide the fact that they are continuing to promulgate deficit spending and then do it on the backs of seniors or the backs of those who can't get access to health care.
Bush also wants to increase Department of Defense spending by $35 billion and to increase the Department of Homeland Security's budget by 11%. Almost every other area would see a budget cut. Bush wants to get rid of about 150 government programs to save around $18 billion. And the president wants Medicare and Medicaid to be cut by $200 billion over the next 5 years. And Bush is still working with Congress to pass a nearly $150 billion economic stimulus package. Irons says Bush's program cuts will hurt the same people he says he wants to help.
And so you see, on one hand, a stimulus package, which is supposed to help the economy. And at the other hand, you see a bunch of reductions to programs that are going to really put a burden on people.
Bush's budget will be getting heavy scrutiny from Congress in the coming months. Administration officials will start coming to the Capitol this week to defend their budget requests. North Dakota Democratic Senator Kent Conrad is the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. He says Bush is out of touch with the nation. Conrad says the president doesn't understand that cities and people are dependent on certain programs.
The COPS program that has put 100,000 police officers on the street, president says cut that 100%. Weatherization assistance, when we know energy prices have skyrocketed, we know that there is really an environmental need to reduce our demand for energy. The president says weatherization assistance ought to be cut 100%.
When Bush entered office, there was a $236 billion budget surplus. The Congressional Budget Office expects that number to rise to $440 billion next year. Bush has also increased the nation's debt by $4 trillion. Conrad says that is what he'll be remembered for.
The tragedy of the Bush administration will be that they have left a legacy of debt that is truly stunning in proportion. By any historic measure, this administration will go down as the most fiscally irresponsible in the history of the United States, and by a wide margin.
Conrad says this year Americans are being affected the most by Bush's fiscal policies. That is why he and other Democrats will attempt to boost funding to health, housing, and education programs. Last year there was a similar fight, and Bush won. Democrats were able to shift around spending priorities, but Bush vetoed all spending bills that were over his budget numbers. And with this being an election year, analysts expect the budget fight to be even fiercer than before. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Women from India's northeastern state of Manipur have launched a campaign against the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. The law gives extraordinary powers to the Indian military for counterinsurgency operations in several parts of the country. Accusing the security forces of abusing these powers, the organizers are demanding the immediate repeal of the law. Bismila Jilani has more.
The rage against the controversial Armed Forces Special Powers Act, or AFSPA, has been simmering for many years. People resisted the law from its adoption in 1958. The latest agitation is an initiative by Manipuri women who have experienced the law's effects firsthand. 35-year-old Bimolata has lost her two brothers at the hands of Indian soldiers.
The Indian Army is killing innocent people and then labeling them militants. They arrested my two brothers from our home, and 24 hours later, we found their dead bodies. The Army said they were killed in an encounter. This law has given us only widows and orphans. That's why we have launched this agitation to demand repeal of the law.
B.H. Deban, a 24-year-old shopkeeper in Dimapur, was lucky to survive a cruel torture.
I've personally experienced the brutality of this law. I was arrested and mercilessly tortured by the army. This was 2 years ago, but I am still unable to walk properly. The army's torture has left hundreds of innocent people maimed for life.
The Armed Forces Special Powers Act was based on a colonial ordinance introduced by the British to crush the Indian freedom struggle. It came into force in 1958. To tackle the Naga insurgency in India's northeastern region. The law gives the armed forces unrestricted powers to carry out operations against insurgent groups and comes into force automatically when the Indian government designates a territory as a disturbed area. Legal experts say the sweeping powers granted to the armed forces under the law turn it into a license to kill. Prashant Bhushan is a senior Supreme Court advocate.
It gives virtual impunity to the armed forces that whatever they do, even if they kill somebody in cold blood, they will not be held accountable. When you give impunity, especially in states like the Northeast and Kashmir, where you have virtual army rule, it is a license to the armed forces to kill, and that is why so many of these incidents are taking place.
The law has frequently been challenged by human rights groups for violating the basic tenets of the rule of law. Suhas Chakma is director of the Asian Center for Human Rights.
The biggest problem with this act is basically no definition of the crime. How can you have a law which does not define any crime but give enhanced punishment without any judicial scrutiny? You are actually empowering a non-commissioned professor who has no judicial training actually to use his brain, use his judgment and kill people. So this is absolutely illegal. I mean, no civilized society can justify such kind of a law.
The law is presently in force in seven northeastern states, as well as in Kashmir, where armed groups demanding independence are fighting Indian armed forces. Incidents of gross violations of human rights and brutal atrocities, including arbitrary detention, forced disappearances, rape, and extrajudicial killings, have been frequently reported from these areas. Zahiruddin, editor of Srinagar-based News Daily Ittalaat, says India has used the act as a war weapon against Kashmiris.
in Kashmir. It has been used as a weapon of war by the government of India. It has encouraged the armed forces to resort to custodial violence, to commit human rights violations. They know that the government is there to shield them.
But India's armed forces insist that the Special Powers Act is necessary. Major General Afsar Karim says repealing the law would be a mistake.
The Armed Forces Act.
It will be absolutely wrong to repeal the law because it is generally used against terrorists who do not obey any rules. What they know is only violence, and if you do not give some special powers to the army, they will not be able to act.
While the campaign appears to be gaining momentum with a large section of civil society expressing solidarity and support, it remains to be seen as to whether it will be able to impact the corridors of power. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Now, from Pennsylvania Death Row, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The corporate elections. Do you ever wonder why certain candidates get mega coverage and others get none? That's because the corporate media concentrates more on a candidate's funds than their positions. And they concentrate on the money race precisely because that money, for the most part, lands in the hands of the media industry. Because media companies profit so handsomely from such donations, they can hardly be considered fair or objective arbiters of either debates or other campaign coverage. The money race influences the horse race. The horse race influences the media. And the media influences millions of voters, which starts the cycle anew. I need not go into the phenomenon of pack journalism, for you've all seen it recently, where every media outlet gets it wrong in their predictions of how voters will vote. And because of media power, those candidates who can't garner tens of millions before elections are either ignored or treated as colorful figures of sidebar interest. Thus, neither Dennis Kucinich, who just quit the race, Ron Paul, or Mike Gravel can be taken seriously, even though all have been elected to Congress repeatedly by healthy margins, because many of their messages conflicted with a market-led conventional wisdom. They've been virtually ignored, and most have been barred from public debates. We've been told they're not serious contenders because they haven't raised serious money, even though Paul handily beat Rudolph Giuliani in several states, coming in second in Nevada. He's not serious, yet Giuliani is. Money rules the roost. It's been said that money is the mother's milk of politics. It keeps the status quo static, for it winnows out those whose views do not cut the corporate mustard. In a nation where money rules almost everything, why would it no longer rule the political process? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Tana Gousset, headlines editor Nell Abram, DC editor Leanne Caldwell, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Puck Lowe, and Rose Kadabchi. I'm Jess Burns in Eugene, Oregon.